KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture on the Hearsay Culture Network. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as affiliated with the University of North Carolina's Center for Information Technology and Public Life, and the University of Milan's Information Society Law Center. Today, I am excited to have back on the show a guest who's been on the show at least once, and I think so, and who I've known since my time at Stanford when I was a fellow, Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, the Robertson Professor of Modern Media Studies. Hearsay Culture listeners will be familiar with Shiva's work, the author of several books. I think the last time you were on, Shiva, we talked about the Googleization of everything.
Probably, yeah.
So it's been that
a decade ago.
But we have been, of course, in touch and talking through social media and other venues since then. Today, we are going to be chatting with Shiva, whose resume is extensive, but I'll simply say is one of the pioneers in the internet space, the internet policy space, really overlapping with law as well, heavily in copyright issues, but also a prolific author both of mainstream media books as well as scholarly works. I'll leave it there because people can find all Shiva's works all over the place. But today, we are going to be discussing an article that Shiva wrote for The Nathan. That was we're recording on December 20th. This was published just a few days ago, entitled "Elon Musk's Real Threat to Democracy Isn't What You Think." And before my listeners say, "Okay, here we go with another," running down of Elon Musk, which has been well done in the media, we're going to kind of pass by that and focus on the substance of the article, which frankly is not well reflected in the title as is sometimes the case, which focuses really on the ways that Elon Musk's businesses operate in spaces that private entities traditionally do not operate in. In the case of this article, we're going to be talking about Starlink, but specifically the New York Times reporting upon which Shiva bases his article of Starlink's use by the Ukrainian military to operate in the Russian-Ukrainian war and Elon Musk's individual power in deciding how that technology is used, in this case, to wage a war of defense and where that leads us. So we're going to be talking about Elon Musk, not as much the man, although that's obviously part of it because he is so much, he personifies his businesses, but I'll say Elon Musk, the conglomerate of businesses, right? And the world in which he operates and what we can take from it. So this is our focus today. Shiva is joining us via Zoom. Shiva, thanks for coming back on the Hearsay Culture Network.
Oh, my pleasure, Dave. Good to be here again.
So
it has been too long, actually.
It has been way too long. And I was looking back and I realized that it has been that long. And of course, which is really kind of want to start off, and this is the way to do it. You know, you and I have been in touch since 2011, but of course, the last time you're on was 2011, and the internet, let's start, was a very different place than it is now.
So back in 2011, we were both concerned about the increasing power of Google. And that's really what my book, The Googleization of Everything, was about, the way in which we had made Google, we'd become dependent on Google for so many crucial things in a very short period of time. And so I was basically trying to get us to be less comfortable with that, right? What Google sold us and continues to sell us is convenience. And I wanted us to question and resist that notion that convenience is the best value or the value we should be promoting. And of course, along with convenience is its corollary efficiency, which economists love and lots of law professors love too, right? But and I wanted to say, like, aren't there deeper, better values that we should be considering when we build out this information ecosystem? And I think what we've seen in the ensuing decade and a couple of years is that we seem to be, and not just in the internet, but in the trajectory of digital technology, we seem to be doubling down on convenience, entertainment, and efficiency at the expense of, even though we're aware of, the extent to which we might want to invest in deliberation, in conversation, in appreciation for each other, right? These values that we've built other institutions to support, but we seem to be undermining those institutions and defunding them and crushing them, like the one in my background here, you know, and the kind we both work for. And at the same time, we seem to be celebrating and shifting our worship to those who would promote efficiency above all other things. Now, that comes at a time since 2015, 16, 17, we've actually had a pretty good public conversation about what we've built and how it has caused problems, undermined democracy, fostered genocide in Myanmar and other places. So it's not like what I'm telling you is the whole story. We actually have a pretty good basis from which to criticize a lot of the moves that we have collectively made over the last 20 years, but we're not actually doing anything about it, right? And now Musk is himself the sort of paradigmatic leader in this process of social engineering, right? The idea that he and I would say his confederates are explicitly involved in the project of creating a new sense of humanity, they hope, a new sense of the world, they hope, one designed along their own values and their own preferences, and with lack of concern for the diversity of other values and the array of other concerns, right? So rebuilding society at the infrastructure level, and almost everything Elon Musk works on is about infrastructure. And those times when he steps beyond infrastructure, like when he bought Twitter and destroyed it, right, he stumbled. So let me set up our conversation with just that framework right there.
Yeah, I, you know, and you know, as we contextualize this discussion, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, the concept of internet utopianism, right? Which, you know, I think you and I really both were part of that. I think it's fair to say that was really existed in the 90s and even into the early 2000s that sure, more or less viewed technology as almost an unbridled good, and if there were downsides, the technology itself would foster the solutions. You know, obviously people view technology, or at least a lot of people, right, view technology much more cynically and in a less utopian manner. Have you thought back on that thinking?
So like when I was doing my early work on copyright, of course, and the digital moment brought us this vision, this opportunity for true democratization of information and an ability to foster and enable new voices and new levels of creativity. And I think we were both concerned that the traditional copyright system, as morphed in the 90s, was actually working against that potential for creative effervescence. Right. When I look back on those days, I think I can call it a draw. I think we've had tremendous creative effervescence around the world, often fostered by digital technology, but we've also had the continuance of dinosaurs, of monsters that have managed to create ways to tax us and distract us and sometimes overcharge us with our cultural products. But we've also seen the emergence of a new set of oligarchs. So in 2004, I had a book called The Anarchists in the Library, where I mapped out these two models and said neither one of these models are good for human flourishing in the 21st century. One is the anarchistic model, this notion that there will be no sense of authority, or there might be no sense of authority that judges what is good and what is proper in our conversations and our collaborations, that everything will be improvisational. And while there are some virtues to that, I thought there would be real costs to any Republican form of government, right? Smaller Republican form of government. And on the other side, the oligarchs, who are not invested or interested in Republican forms of government anyway, but wanted merely to, you know, seek rent and charge and control. And I thought that what we were building was an information ecosystem designed to, or allowing both anarchists and oligarchs to battle it out for our attention and possibly create the worst possible combination of the two. And I'm afraid it came true. And what we didn't foster were those institutions, habits of mind, habits of culture that can actually foster the sort of deep learning, deep deliberation that digital technology might have made possible with a few different choices. Had we invested in public infrastructure, had we invested in public forms of knowledge distribution and knowledge preservation, we might have had, and it's not like we did none of it, but we underinvested in it. We might have actually created a much more enlightened 21st century. And I don't think anyone can look back at the first quarter of the 21st century and say that we as a species are more enlightened and ready to take on the challenges than we were, you know, in 1999.
It is remarkable, you know, the information wants to be free mindset very much seems to have, you know, I think unintentionally denigrated what some people are now talking about in a reinvigoration of civic values.
Right.
But also to your point, and my question is the deliberative process, which seems to be lacking. One thing that I was curious about in thinking about your article, but also in thinking about Musk, is when I teach this topic, right? And for a number of years, I talked about the Arab Spring, right? I talked about how and putting aside it happens to be Twitter, but the idea was that you've got social media networks, but the internet that as an infrastructure allows people to communicate outside of hyper-repressive communities, cultures, countries, right? Yeah. And make connections that allows the world to have a better understanding of what is happening in places where we otherwise would have relied on press, right? And yet somehow it seems like there's less understanding of each other as a result of this technology. Where did we go wrong?
So I don't know if it's a result of the technology, but it's definitely in collaboration with certain ways that the technologies sort of structure our interactions. So what I mean by that is we can go back to 2011. And what really happened in 2011 was a Mediterranean-wide youth uprising. This was often missed in the story, right? The story is all about the political change, first in Tunisia and then Egypt, and the overthrowing of two very sclerotic dictatorships, both of which, by the way, have ended up worse than what we had before. But putting that particular thing aside, the story we all missed, actually, I'm not sure all of us missed it, but the real story there was not about social media. It was about young people across the Mediterranean, from Barcelona to Athens to Tel Aviv, Alexandria, Tunis, and all the way across to Morocco, rising up and saying, we have minimal opportunities, we have tremendous corruption, our rent is too high, our job opportunities are too low, and we have so many resources concentrated among so few people in all of those places. And those resources could be opportunities or straight up wealth. And they all basically had the same complaint. And there were uprisings in all of those cities. And we missed all that. And yes, people used the tools available to them, their phones. And by the way, the major method of communication across all of this was SMS texting, using the old Nokia phones that were so dependable. Right? Right. 2011, not a lot of people had smartphones. So not a lot of people actually had Facebook and Twitter. In fact, almost nobody in Egypt used Facebook or Twitter. Facebook and Twitter were important for the rest of the world to understand what was going on in a place that was at that point basically devoid of journalists. But the real energy and agenda there, I think we missed. And that disaffection continues throughout the world, and we see it in various forms throughout the world. And you know, when you look at the color revolutions in the former Soviet states, when you look at Occupy in this country, you see elements of it, and you can see a right wing version of it in various places around the country, around the world as well, right? You know, we've seen echoes of it time and time again. I think we missed that story. The role of technology in that has been that our technological changes have given rise to higher expectations. It's given people around the world a sense of how others live and what others have and what others have not. And it has, you know, created this really distorted field of awareness. But it has definitely raised all of our expectations for a better life at a moment when across the world, young people are facing worse prospects than we did when we were young. And that disaffection is being channeled through these services that, you know, gosh, are in cahoots with the Chinese government, right? In the case of TikTok, or are being run by a megalomaniac in the case of Twitter slash X, right? So it's just this really bizarre thing that we've built. And it's not at all what, you know, John Perry Barlow imagined we were building in the 1990s when he idealized this new world that he saw as exceptional and distinct from our physical worlds. And it's not quite what the Chinese government would like to build, right? There are ways in which it's succeeding and ways in which it's failing to build a complete surveillance system, you know, and extend it beyond China. But again, those are the two models we're dealing with. And it's not satisfying the needs, the information needs, the communication needs, and the wealth distribution needs of the great majority of humans. Meanwhile, all of these machines are burning carbon like we've never done before. So that's a whole other story.
Which is, yes, which we probably don't even have time for even in the time frame we have on Hearsay Culture. We're chatting with Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia on Hearsay Culture and the Hearsay Culture Network on KZSU. So let's turn to, you know, the man of the hour, certainly, you know, maybe the decade, maybe the century, Elon Musk. The focus here being not Musk as much as the person, but what Musk has put together. So I read the title, but the title of the article doesn't really tell you what the article is. The subtitle does. It's better. How the attention-starved CEO took over our communications infrastructure.
That's right.
And that's what the article is much more about. So I'm going to ask a better question than that and start here. We've got these infrastructural companies that Musk owns. We hear about Twitter or X. We hear about SpaceX. Those are the two, you know, that have been very successful. We have Tesla, right, which also is very well known. But then you've got Starlink, which we don't hear about much, and the Boring Company, which is the weirdest of Musk's entities.
So really weirder than Neuralink?
I think, well, weirder in terms of what it's actually done or not done, as the case may be. So it's a weird place to start, but let's put aside the big ticket entities. We're going to talk about Neuralink shortly, but the infrastructure concept that Musk does embody in a lot of ways, I think is reflected in this concept of the Boring Company. Talk a little bit about that one.
I mean, I haven't been able to figure out what exactly the Boring Company hopes to accomplish, right? It's a pun. It basically, as far as I can tell, is designed to build tunnels
Tunnels, right.
that might at some point carry vehicles through them at some rate of speed, which sounds to me like a subway, but
Right,
what do I know, right? And there have been lots of moments where Musk has convinced political leaders in California and other places that he's like ready to build some amazing project for them that'll transform life in their cities. But as far as I can tell, nothing has really happened. It's a privately owned entity too, so there's really no oversight. There are no shareholders to ask what's going on, like what's up the next quarter. It's a very opaque organization. And I have no idea of the what six companies he runs, how many hours per day he spends on the Boring Company.
Well, and it reflects, but that's kind of the point. Like in a weird microcosm, it reflects Musk's way of doing business, which you describe, and of course, other publications describe this as well. How would you describe, and I don't mean the man who is the ridiculous, odd things on X. How would you describe Musk, the manager, and visionary of sorts of these entities? What is he doing? What is his
Well,
style?
he is a wannabe engineer, right? So he's not actually an engineer in the sense that he's never actually done the work of an engineer. But he envisions and imagines new ways of living. And he's very informed by science fiction, although from what I can tell, he doesn't actually read it very well, because he, as with so many people in Silicon Valley, reads the dystopian works and thinks they're utopian. Or even often the satirical works and thinks that they're utopian. But he really believes, and in this way, he's not so different from Mark Zuckerberg. He really believes that he has the knowledge, authority, and rectitude to alter our fundamental ways of being, to address the biology that guides us, to direct the basically how we get from point A to point B, to direct how we might interact with other heavenly bodies, right? This really sort of totalizing audacity of vision that he's able to summon the money and hire just enough talent to make many of these projects seem doable, but very few people ever get to ask, is it a good idea? Right? The question is always, can it be done, and not should it be done? Half the things the Boring Company says it's going to do, we should be asking, like, is that good? Neuralink, which we've just sort of dropped in there, right? This idea that we would implant things in our neural system that would enhance our ability to think collectively. I guess that's their vision, but according to whose guidelines, right? Who would build in the structures and affordances of this Neuralink system? Well, of course, Musk and the people he pays, right? So
And it is a remark. I mean, it is remarkable. So I want to play for us the particular way that Musk has described his own vision for a few of these companies. This is a video, a clip from an interview that he did a couple of years ago at an event hosted by CNET. I don't want to play it and get your reaction.
I suppose so. What SpaceX is trying to do is to extend consciousness, the scope and scale of consciousness beyond Earth. And then what Tesla is trying to do is to sort of ensure that life is good on Earth, with sustainable energy. Neuralink is sort of oriented towards long-term AI human symbiosis. So, I mean, generally these companies are oriented towards like what actions can I think of to do to maximize the probability that the future is good. And that future includes the an expansion of the scope and scale of consciousness.
So it is remarkable to hear Musk talk this kind of language, and it animates so much of what he does. But what's your reaction to his own description of the mission of these companies?
So every time I hear anybody, especially Musk, spout that kind of language, I say, well, who asked you to envision or imagine what a better life is, right? Is it really up to one billionaire or even a collection of billionaires? And by the way, he is part of a collection of billionaires who are thoroughly convinced that they know what is best for the years and decades ahead. And this like this confidence that they will figure out how we should live, how we should think, how we should interact. They will figure out where we should live. They will figure out how we should get from point A to point B. Is really stunning. It's so authoritarian at its core, right? It's paternalistic. But it's bizarre because they're officially libertarians in so many ways, but they're paternalistic libertarians.
This is what I want to push you on, because CEOs have visions,
right?
If a CEO lacks vision, I think Jack Welch, right? You know, famous CEO would say you don't belong there, right? So there's nothing weird about a CEO or for that matter, right? You know, a wealthy person thinking they know best how to do things. But
how to do things for their company.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Which is a very narrow slice of life on Earth. Right. So Jack Welch rarely presented himself as a person who could re-engineer the world, let alone the United States, let alone the world. Right. Mm-hmm. He re-engineered one company, and it's debatable whether even the company in the long run is better off because of what he did, but he had a good run. Right.
Yeah.
If you want to take him as the paradigmatic CEO of the last 75 years, pretty good argument for it. Mm-hmm. His audacity stopped at General Electric, he wasn't trying to redesign humanity, right? And that is the difference.
I'm trying to conceptualize before we take our break, just how to, in a short period of time, how to think about Musk within this broader scheme. Is he akin to, of sorts, a robber baron? Now, he's not building libraries yet, but the robber barons at least had a concept that their wealth, right, with maybe not within the company, as your point, outside the company, should be used for the greater good. And when Musk articulates his vision, he is talking about humanity, and in a weird way, his destruction of Twitter, right, which is not really the focus of our discussion today, but Twitter is in his view, part of having to run a company that is missing the vision. It turns out his vision of speech, whatever that is. So is there a way to analogize him to the robber barons of old?
Only to the extent to which many of the robber barons bought into the ideology of the moment, which was social Darwinism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the sense that we should structure our political economy so that we don't encourage dependence, that we don't promote the feeble-minded to breed, that we enhance the greater races, those sorts of themes that come out of the social Darwinism of the 19th century and spread well into the 20th century through the eugenics movement and all of that. Though there were some robber barons who took that all very seriously, and there were many professors who took that very seriously as well. So it wasn't just robber barons. This new breed, I would put Musk and Zuckerberg as a sort of a lighter version. I would put the Google guys here. I would put all the people involved in OpenAI on this level of being in some ways brand new. In some ways, they are oligarchs of a new breed because of their complete faith in themselves and in the tools that they are presenting to us. Their faith that those tools can transform us, right? And so there's a certain spirituality to it. There's an ethic to it that is very much about anticipating the needs of humanity 100 or 500 years from now and taking the hits and sacrifices today. So if that means like we trash this planet so we can inhabit Mars, so be it, right? If that means that we have to, in a very hyper utilitarian way, wipe out people who live today to ensure the continuance of the species in the future, that's the way it goes. It means ignoring the immediate effects of climate change and worrying about the long term effects of climate change. It means not worrying very much about democracy because democracy is slow and deliberative and has to take into account multiple points of view, and we don't have time for that, right? That's the vulgar utilitarian philosophy that guides them, and it really is part of their conversation. And when you add to it the fact that people keep throwing money at them, and there is no point at which anyone ever calls them on their shtick, it means that they just go for it. And when they have the resources, they can do great damage, right? So look at the current rhetoric about AI and the alleged ethical AI movement that OpenAI embodies, right? The story we keep getting told by the very people who are building these services is that what we have to worry about with artificial intelligence is not that predictive policing is brutalizing communities today in Los Angeles, in Houston, in Milwaukee. It's not that using predictive algorithms to work on sentencing guidelines in places like Ohio and Wisconsin is creating problems for people. It's not that there are AI-guided missiles flying in various parts of the world today with no way of knowing how appropriate and effective that sort of targeting is, right? Those are actual real day challenges and problems where people are getting hurt. We are told, look away from that. Look at the possibility of sentient AI, taking charge of the world in 50 years. Well, no. That assumes that, first of all, you know what you're doing and you can actually build the stuff you say you're going to build, which almost never happens. But it also is meant to distract us and make us think that, oh, these people are very caring and concerned when they are building out the systems, that engage in tremendous intrusive surveillance on people every day and cause actual damage in the world today, right? So that kind of destruction is all fed in, again, by this confidence and the fact that so many people in journalism and government worship these people or because they don't quite want to understand what's going on, they just take their word for everything when they say, oh, we're going to build this or we're going to do this. And what we're seeing, and I'm paying a lot of attention right now to what's happening in and around Austin, Texas.
Let me interrupt you quickly, Shiva, and just say you're listening to KZSU FM Stanford, and here saying you're on a roll, and normally I might interrupt even sooner, but this is good. So I do want to do the station break and just say KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that operates on donations, which people don't realize. So please do reach out if you're interested to donate at here at kzsu.stanford.edu, and you can check out Hearsay Culture Network at hearsayculture.com. So I interrupted you, and you were about to talk about Austin,
Right.
So I do want to hear what the connection, I think I could guess, but go ahead. Yeah.
Right. So look, Elon Musk is basically building out his empire in and around Austin, Texas.
Right.
Mostly in this small town called Bastrop, which is about 25 miles east of Austin. And it was a farming community. When I lived there, I lived in Austin for 14 years in the late 20th century. And loved the place dearly. Right. I moved to the town where, basically Willie Nelson was the most successful and notable Austin citizen at the time, maybe Lady Bird Johnson, right? It was Lady Bird's town. It was Willie Nelson's town. Yeah. We had a state capitol. Nobody really paid attention. It was not a state capitol. We had a university and, Texas Instruments up the road. Now it is Tesla Center, right? It is overrun by money. It is also being infected, and its political culture and its policies being distorted by this collection of Elon Musk's buddies, many of whom are investing in firms that are doing business in Austin, but also investing in the political infrastructure of Austin and Texas. And they are doing everything they can to make sure that housing is less affordable, doing everything they can to make sure there are no environmental regulations anymore, whatever environmental regulations that people of Central Texas fought for decades are being gutted at the state capitol level, often funded by these billionaires. So there's this libertarian spirit of a particular kind, right? The paternalistic libertarianism that's coming in to Austin, and the money is flowing largely through the state capitol, through the Republicans who run the state of Texas. And they are completely taking over many aspects of day-to-day life in and around Austin. And by the way, it's also affecting Houston and Dallas, two heavily Democratic cities with huge minority populations. We've just seen the Houston school district taken over by the state. So the people of Houston can no longer have a say in how their children are educated, right? Those are examples that are emanating from the state capitol. But also it's involved in local politics in Austin, which is now one of the, one of the 12 largest cities in the country. And this is all early, but I'm paying a lot of attention right now to who the players are in local politics in Austin and how connected they are to the PayPal group, right? The PayPal mafia, including Elon Musk, because a lot of that money came from that small group of guys who were in and around Stanford and Silicon Valley, 20 years ago.
Well, I was about to say the overlap with Silicon Valley, of course, directly, right? At least the main tech companies in Silicon Valley, as you know, were not heavily involved in policy for a number of years. And they became newsworthy when lobbyists were hired, right, by Google.
Right.
There were stories of, oh my God, but of course, this was the encroachment of regulation, right?
Yeah.
And after the Stop Online Piracy Act, which is another
topic.
And something we worked on together. Let's turn in the remaining about 15 or so minutes that we have to the article itself.
Sure.
Because this, from what you're describing in Austin, right, Starlink is very much kind of a precursor, although arguably even a bigger deal, right, precursor scenario. The story of Starlink and Ukraine, which was covered by the New York Times, but then didn't get the attention I thought it would, so here we are, right, is really an amazing one. Can you summarize for my listeners what it is that Starlink is controlling and operating that space?
Look, if you live anywhere rural in North America, you know how hard it is to get decent high-speed internet service. And during the pandemic, we found out just how many schools can't get decent high-speed internet service to their communities. And so it's a huge problem in rural North America. Imagine how bad it is, how challenging it is in rural parts of Africa, in rural parts of Central Asia, in rural parts of Southeast Asia, in most of Brazil, right? So given that, there is this real need, serious need for high quality, dependable internet service. Now we could string fiber optic cable all around the world through the jungles, over the mountains. That's super expensive and will take decades, and nobody's gonna pull in the money it takes to do that, right? The marginal return for every mile of fiber optic cable running through the Amazon is minimal, right? Or the Sahara Desert, right? Is minimal, probably close to zero, right? So why would anyone fund that? And there's no particular government. The government of Chad's not going to do it, right? So who steps in? Well, two people, Jeff Bezos and right. Elon Musk, who have their respective rocket companies. And they both do what a lot of people have been suggesting for a long time, which is create a collection, a constellation of low altitude, fairly small, fairly inexpensive satellites that can bounce internet traffic across them. And they don't have to be geosynchronous. They can move around because it's all packet switching. It's the basic technology that we use to reassemble this video and this audio at this great distance can easily be bounced around satellites just below space, right? So there was a race, there has been a race, and it's a race that Musk and Starlink are winning. Starlink has been throwing these satellites up there by the thousands and crowding out all competition, including any government that might want to build out its own satellite network and govern itself. So because Musk is basically doing it for a fairly low price, he's succeeding, and he's sort of, it's a lost leader. Eventually he will own the infrastructure of tremendous amounts of internet traffic around the world, and he can ratchet up the price. But for now, I'm sure he's losing money. But SpaceX, the company that runs Starlink, of course, is subsidized by us. The U.S. taxpayers are paying billions of dollars to Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, to launch satellites so NASA doesn't have to. And as a result, we are paying for Elon Musk to control internet infrastructure in vast parts of the world, including Ukraine. So after Russia invaded Ukraine and immediately knocked out much of the communication infrastructure of that country, people in the Ukrainian government managed to get hold of Elon Musk actually through Twitter and say, hey, can you help us? We need to get our domestic network back up. Can you like bring more stations? Because you have to have like a terrestrial station to communicate with the satellites. Bring more stations in, put more satellites above us. And Musk said, sure, sounds like a good idea. I'm not in favor of war. This is a big invasion. I want to help the people of Ukraine, right? So he started rolling this out. Now, had to be done. Good that he did it. The problem is that both the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian army became deeply dependent on this network, right, to the point where, of course, the army, because it's an army of people who were not really professional soldiers a year ago, they're doing everything they can with this network, including trying to run drones off of the network, trying to use it to communicate with forward troops. So at about last year, Musk was getting some warnings from people in the Russian government saying, if you have to be careful, you are helping the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian army. And if they cross over into Crimea, which of course is officially supposed to be territory controlled by Ukraine that was stolen by Russia in 2014, if Ukrainian troops cross over into Crimea, that could lead to nuclear war. Now, Elon Musk wants to be the daddy of all of us, right? Wants to care for us, doesn't want nuclear war, does not want to be responsible for nuclear war. So he decided that he would geofence the satellite communications from Starlink. So what the Ukrainian army found was when they crossed some line.
To be clear, she would just interrupt you, this key point. He decided. Right. As far as we know, and I'm curious if you discover anything different in your own research and reporting, as far as we know, he didn't consult the State Department, the Department of Defense, or anyone else. He just unilaterally decided we're doing this. Is that right? I mean, that is right, Russia. Isn't it?
He did consult the Russian government.
Yeah. Well, right. Because he got the request. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, it was just like a thing he decided. And this was documented in Walter Isaacson's biography or hagiography of Musk, and then reconfirmed by both the New Yorker and the Times at different times. And so basically he gets to decide where the border is between Ukraine and Russia. He gets to decide that the Ukrainian army can't go any farther. Now, since that moment when he basically left the Ukrainian army unable to communicate with forward troops, the U.S. government has persuaded him to make some adjustments and actually got into some sort of contract that we can't know the details of. So something has changed in his deal with the U.S. government, with the Pentagon, with the State Department, but we don't know the terms of that. Everyone's been very secretive about it, probably for very good reason. Right. Nonetheless, it's ultimately his decision.
Right.
And this is just what's happening in Ukraine. So I'm fascinated by this question of how a country like Ukraine can maintain its sense of sovereignty when so much power is embedded in one person's judgment.
Well, it's a remarkable scenario because the follow-up report, at least in the immediate days after this came out, right, was that you had U.S. Secretary of State Blinken negotiating with Musk,
right,
and treating him as a state leader of sorts, right, in terms of the discussions, which you know happens. It does happen, right? I mean, there are powerful individuals, but I can't think of a scenario I don't know if you can think of a reported scenario where you had one person's company dictating whether a war will be promulgated in a given place or not.
Right.
Based upon not armies, guns, and the things you think of, but by controlling the means of communication and in that sense being operating at a global level. I mean, am I wrong? I mean, are there any parallels that directly in
the only one I can think of is JP Morgan in the early 20th century financing,
right?
Basically financing, you know, World War One, and helping finance World War Two. Although it's debatable which side he was financing in World War Two. So, but that's just about pumping money. That's not just that's a huge thing, right? That, and look, when people around the world, especially in the United States, saw one person, the richest person in the world at that time, exercising so much power, we changed things, right? We rose up through our systems of governance and we said, we must distribute power. We must break up companies' trust. We must make sure that nobody has that much power over the major decisions that might be life or death decisions. No one person. That's why we have democratically elected governments, to be able to do better. And even if they're not democratically elected, at least they're countervailing powers at work in the world. So this idea that one person should have this much power, it should be so noxious. But look at the ways in which the Biden administration has to bow to this person because we have become so dependent on him so quickly, even though he's dependent on the Biden administration and the Obama administration. Like, Musk is as rich as he is because of the massive government subsidies to SpaceX and to Tesla. He is the biggest beneficiary of federal spending and tax breaks of anybody in the world. Nobody lives off the U.S. government fatter than Elon Musk. Musk gets to call the shot.
Well, but here's, you know, I can imagine listeners saying, but wait a minute, no one was building this network that allowed communication in parts of the world where it wasn't profitable. So Musk invested, right? He might be losing money. Of course, they're private entities. We don't really know, You might, so he gets to make that call. If the UN, I mean, I'm making this up, right? But if the UN or the US government or, you know, name your, you know, ICANN, I mean, that's ridiculous. But the point is, if some internet entity wanted to do it, or then they would get to decide.
So absolutely. This is the problem here. Like, I can make fun of Musk. You can make fun of Musk. We can criticize him. He's a misogynist. He's an anti-Semite. He's a transphobe. All of which are true, right? He's not a big fan of democracy. A big problem. And yet, the guy can do what he wants to do with whatever he buys. Absolutely. But that's only because we let him. That's only because our government and our leaders have capitulated to him. We had a moment, and it might not be too late, when governments of the world could have built out that infrastructure. The vision was there. The technology is not that sophisticated. It's actually not that expensive. We could have done it. We gave tax breaks to people like Musk instead, but we could have done that. We could have actually had a true global communication network with reasonable rules and reasonable regulations and reasonable access at reasonable cost, and worked out the details in international negotiations. And it actually could have been a major move forward, for instance, to enforce American hegemony over the global internet, which, by the way, we've lost.
Well, so, and
not
right,
that I want to, you know, champion American hegemony, but there was a moment, better American hegemony than Musk hegemony or China hegemony, because that's really what we've got coming.
Well, and right. And, you know, I mean, the irony, because we come full circle, is, of course, as you alluded to, is that the internet was supposed to be that. And in its earliest incarnations, you know, the John Perry Barlow kind of, you know, model, which of course comes out of the 60s and what have you, but the idea that, you know, that the U.S. did have that opportunity and has lost it. So in the last few minutes that we have here, and we really have two. So the final question here, Shiva, and this has been terrific. We've been chatting with Shiva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia on Hearsay Culture and the Hearsay Culture Network. What do we learn from this? I mean, I invite you back, and I mean that sincerely, not, you know, it's the holiday season. So we'll do something in January.
February.
Invite you back to kind of part two of this, which is now what do we do, which we both been alluding to. But what do we take? What are the lessons of this story of Starlink and Ukraine and control of infrastructure that you would want listeners to take from this?
So number one, everything is political. Like, nothing that is allegedly technological is separate from the social, the cultural, the economic, and the political. Everything is political, right? And so we have to approach these questions politically. Where is the power getting vested? Who gets to exercise power? How is power accountable and to whom? And that's why we have institutions of government, to have power curbed, flowed, revealed, and regulated. And we forget that. We've had this crazy 50 years, maybe 60 years of ideological surrender, saying if we just let the rich guys do what the rich guys want to do, things will be okay, when there is no evidence to that claim. In fact, we have to take back control over these big systems that, through which power flows. And this is a perfect example of a missed opportunity. The failure of the public to take seriously the need and opportunity to build out infrastructure that could be reasonably deployed and reasonably governed, and instead we had a vacuum that Elon Musk, of all people, stuck himself into. I mean, we wouldn't be having the same conversation if Jeff Bezos had been the first mover. Jeff Bezos isn't as noxious a person, as horrible a person as Elon Musk. It still would have been a big problem, right? And this was ultimately the argument I made in the Googleization of everything, that we allowed, at a time when we could have built out a global information ecosystem based on the principles of public librarianship, instead we surrendered and said, hey, Google, why don't you do it? You know, we won't have to pay anything up front. We might pay in various invisible ways for many decades, which we clearly are.
Well, and of course, you know, in closing, this is exactly what we're confronting, as you alluded to earlier, with regard to AI being decided by Sam Altman on November 30th, 2022, that now is the time for humanity to deal with it, which I've got to stop you on, because I know you want to jump on that. Why?
That's all right. Maybe we'll do it again in a little while.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We've been chatting with Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan on Hearsay Culture and KGFM Stanford. Shiva, thanks again for joining me today. I recommend the article in The Nation, published December 11th, Elon Musk's Real Threat to Democracy Isn't What You Think. Important subtitle, more important, how the attention star CEO took over our communications infrastructure. Shiva, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure, Dave. See you soon.
The Hearsay Culture Network can be found at hearsayculture.com and on your favorite platforms. But for now, this is going to be the last show recorded in 2023. Look for a more formal, bigger launch in 2024. I wish everyone a happy holiday season, a healthy and safe new year. Thank you for listening to KZSU today, and stay tuned for more diverse programming. Have a great day.